Welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up a bit later in the show, Matt Olien reviews the new movie Anora, which he thinks will have Oscar legs. It's a drama about the sex industry and a comedy too. We'll see what Matt thinks about the new movie. Also, Dave Thompson and I will review this week's news, and Dave will tell us he thinks the North Dakota legislature is about to focus on nuclear power to meet the state's increasing power demands. But first, we'll visit with Robbie Hassett. She's a permanent supported housing case manager for the Grand Forks Housing Authority, and also Callie Smith. She's a caseworker for Spectra Health. We'll learn about those challenged to find a place to live in Grand Forks as we recognize National Hunger and Homelessness Awareness Week. Robbie Hassett, welcome to Main Street.
Welcome. Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Callie Smith, nice to meet you. Welcome to Main Street.
Nice to meet you, too. Thank you for having us today.
November 17th through the 23rd is National Hunger and Homelessness Awareness Week.
Yeah.
What does that mean? What is it that you want people to understand?
Especially at the Grand Forks level, we want to make it more applicable to what's happening in our community and that there is local issues happening. Yeah, you hear about it a bit more in other states or the larger metropolitans, but in Grand Forks, the hunger and homelessness rates are actually quite staggering with like our 40,000, 50,000 population.
Do you think that people who live in Grand Forks or the region think that this area has a homelessness problem?
I think it's growing more because we're seeing more unsheltered people. Like I've worked here for 3 years, which isn't that long, but there's definitely been an increase each year with those folks who are walking around outside that might appear to look like they're experiencing homelessness or, panhandling
or
whatnot.
Why are the numbers rising?
So I would say we don't have permanent supportive housing options such as like LaGrave on First, which allows a large number of people to be housed who have been previously homeless. We have how many homeless people, and we only have a couple spots a month opening up that would get them housed right away with supportive services. I would also say we have a lot of caseworkers and things, right? But the lack of ability to provide supportive services, and maybe just the numbers aren't, we're all overworked, but to be able to provide supportive services after someone's housed causes a cycle, I feel like, a lot of times to happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
We've seen a huge spike in first-time homelessness recently, but if you're not able to correct it, it can become just one of those things that you can't get out of.
Do you perceive that people are coming to Grand Forks who are homeless, or they are Grand Forks residents who, for whatever reason, sadly become homeless?
I'd say mostly local, yeah.
And I want to speak politically correct. Is homeless an acceptable term?
It's that person first language that you want to say, individuals or families experiencing homelessness, because the point is to highlight that it's just an instance in somebody's life and not, hopefully, an ongoing chronic issue. If you're homeless one time, you're experiencing it in that moment. Sometimes people only experience it for a month. Sometimes it's 3 months. Sometimes it is on a chronic basis, but you don't want it to be the label on somebody forever. That's the goal.
Generally speaking, do you feel that North Dakota in general has fewer people who are experiencing homelessness or more people who are experiencing homelessness compared to the rest of our country?
I think there's a different kind of homelessness here simply because of the weather. It's harder to gauge and things. I always say people are resourceful, right? We see people die every year here because of the cold, right? I mean, at least a couple usually, but most people scatter, right? I see people outside all summer long, and then it gets to a certain point and they're resourceful. They find places to go. I mean, unfortunately there's things like just survival stuff that maybe is like survival sex, drug use, things like that. But that's because people are trying to find a way to survive. And
yeah, I guess I was just going to agree with that with the weather patterns here that I'd imagine, well, I know people find a way to stay with somebody or get inside during the winter usually, but then it contributes to the cycle of people being evicted because people are not authorized to stay in their apartment.
I also want to speak on the criminalization because it also becomes, I have currently someone in jail right now who was just pulled to be at LaGrave. They've been on the street sleeping all summer long, and when they got pulled, they ended up the night before trying to stay somewhere inside of like a doorway of an apartment building. They got a second trespassing in under 2 years, and now they're sitting 8 months and they lost their chance, which is super unfortunate because you just wanted to not be cold that night.
You talked about LaGrave on First, Robbie. What is that?
So that's our permanent supportive, let me get this right, permanent supportive housing building, I guess. And it's basically, it has 42 apartments. They're all furnished. The way they're selected is we have kind of a coordinated entry system where people do an assessment with someone like myself or Callie, or I don't know, do you do them or not?
But yes.
Okay. And then they become on a list. They call it a prioritization list, which I don't like to call it that because it makes it sound like you're prioritizing people, but it's just to see who's the most vulnerable and most in need. And as spots open up there, they can be housed there, like I said, with fully furnished, with supportive services on site. It does not require that you use the services, but they are available to you.
Like what?
Yeah, like there's supportive case management afforded to you. There's a nurse on site. There's lots of like resident service coordinator on site. I know they partner with churches. They get meals most days cooked for them there.
42 apartments to me sounds like a good number. That doesn't meet the need though?
No, it does not. And I don't know.
Huge spike actually lessened, I guess the numbers decreased a lot. I believe after that first opened, you know?
Yeah, I think it was 6-7 years ago now. I don't want to say
now that. COVID didn't help, you know, with a lot of the stuff with people experiencing homelessness. As far as the permanent supportive housing goes, it's just a housing first philosophy, right? Which is that says if you house someone with no strings attached, don't make them be ready to be housed, that they're gonna, I mean, I guess evidence-based, and tells you that they will more likely to succeed, and then the other things can be worked on, right? Like, it's easy to get housing, but you maintain it is the hard part.
What have your statistics told you about that?
So nationally, I know that the statistics are quite good on housing retention. That doesn't mean that everyone there is becoming sober and in constant recovery or don't get any, you know, criminal charges against them, but the housing retention piece, that they have a safe place to stay, a roof over their head, it is better with housing first policies.
Before we move on, how long on average does someone stay?
They could stay there forever if they would like. There's at least one I know successfully, because you stay there a year and then you can transfer. It's like a voucher similar to what they have at housing authorities tied to that property, then you can move if you would like anywhere that would accept it. Some people choose to transfer out and like live, I don't want to say more independently, because people live independently there, but they would rather be somewhere else. There's at least, I don't want to speak on it because I don't actually work in that building, but there's a handful of people that have been there since it opened and they're still there.
So as we said at the top, Hunger and Homelessness Awareness Week is coming up. It's November 17th through the 23rd. Why is it important for Grand Forks, for the community, for our state to recognize that?
I think ultimately we should recognize that there are people in our community, our neighbors, our classmates, our colleagues that are experiencing hunger at any point or homelessness at any point. And simply that awareness to what's happening in our community will help boost our efforts and acknowledge that there are social service agencies coming together within CANA. It's representative over 30 plus agencies all working together. That includes our hospital, that includes our shelters, our housing authority,
police
our
officers,
health centers, our police officers. So it's just so that the ordinary people understand, hey, we kind of need your support on some of the volunteering at our nonprofits, donating to our causes, because the state funding is not enough to support the needs in our community. It's just not.
I like to speak on that too. I guess for Hunger and Homelessness Awareness Week, it's also always the week before Thanksgiving, right? And that's kind of symbolic, because as we sit down in our community to have this great feast at home in a warm with all our family and friends, like, it's to bring awareness that there's people out there suffering and not getting enough food, or by themselves out on the street or in a shelter. So I think that we have to remember, we have to humanize them. That's someone's family, that's someone's mom, son, brother. They have a backstory, and if we can humanize them, then I think community members will, you know, support the cause more.
You mentioned CANA. Let's talk more about that. Community Agency Network Association. You said there are a lot of people involved. Directly, what do they do for homelessness or for people who find themselves homeless?
So we as a coalition don't do any direct work as CANA supporting people experiencing homelessness. We're a coalition of 30 plus agencies that work with those individuals. So that's the Housing Authority, Spectra, Ultra, whatnot, where we come together once a month to discuss the needs that are going on in the community, the issues, what needs to improve. It's also just a resource sharing. We also staff some situations right now. Actually, the last year, family homelessness is the top conversation. CANA itself, we're not at the point of some other homeless coalitions where we're able to, like, you know, this is kind of our first year of kind of fundraising for a specific program that we're trying to get off the ground. But other homeless coalitions have some direct financial assistance and stuff. We do not. But again, we talk about the issues, and then the people that are at the table are the people with the power to kind of write those grants or to make some supportive services happen.
What other people in our community think, you know, homelessness is, just by connecting and being all on the same page. I mean, we come together and we're able to, like, change the stereotypes. And if we're able to do that, like, again, we can get maybe some of the NIMBYism that there is present, people on our side, and kind of, because we need the community. We can't just, agencies and service providers can't do it all. We need community to help.
And NIMBYism is not in my backyard, that concept regarding people experiencing homelessness.
And that's a big concept relative to folks who find themselves homeless all across the country.
Right.
We're enjoying our conversation with Robbie Hassett. She's a permanent supported housing case manager for the Grand Forks Housing Authority, and also Callie Smith. She's a caseworker for Spectra Health. All right, November 17th through the 23rd. It's National Hunger and Homelessness Awareness Week. What events are planned?
So we're doing a couple of things, with our main event being a luncheon, the first premier Hunger and Homelessness Awareness Week luncheon fundraiser. The tickets sold for that will go to support our new program, the New Start Nook. That is where all of our fundraising this week is going. And at that luncheon, we are trying to just get anybody in the community, city council members, donors, church members, trying to just get the word out for anybody and everybody who wants to purchase a ticket and listen to speakers from these agencies on what the state of homelessness and hunger is in our community, with some prizes, and Olive Garden is catering. So Monday, and then we're also partnering with three different just restaurants to donate a portion of their proceeds. We did this last year on a smaller scale and just trying to continue that because it's a way to get some funding. So Monday, we're doing Pizza Ranch in Grand Forks, a fundraiser on November 18th. November 21st, there's a fundraiser at Panera Bread online, in cafe, drive-through, pickup, or delivery with the code FUND4U. And then Deke's Pizza on November 27th. We couldn't fit that into the national week, but they are still supporting our cause. And that'll be all day using the code NSN for New Start Nook when ordering.
And you've mentioned New Start Nook. What is that?
Our Hunger and Homelessness Awareness Committee is made up of just different members of CANA who felt passionate to be a part of the efforts that we're doing this week. And as providers, we ultimately decided we wanted to start a donation closet called, and we named it the New Start Nook. And essentially it'll be a closet held in the basement of Love in Action, where we will have brand new items for when somebody is exiting homelessness and moving into an apartment or a home. So that would be like your bed sheets and your dishes and your soap and your cleaning supplies, your can openers. Like, there's so many things that go into, like, making a place just a basic home. And we got some inspiration from the closet at La Grave on First on what they supply their clients. So they're supporting that, and how they developed a system to, an ordering form on clients can actually choose what they want. The reason behind it is because there are resources in the community that do provide dishes and furniture and whatnot, but it takes a week or weeks to get an appointment. So people are moving into a home that is empty, and it's usually on the caseworker to try and scrounge their house or their family friend's house or their, you know, get these things from these agencies. And it takes a lot of time and effort on the caseworker's end to get someone set up before just being like, welcome to your new home.
What might you say is a thing or two that policymakers just don't understand about folks who find themselves in this state of homelessness?
That's a good question.
I think, I guess don't understand would be a word, but I first of all, I want to say we want those people there because we want to recognize too that they have done and supported homelessness mm-hmm. and hunger in our community. There's, LaGrave on first, there's a lot of things that we've gotten, the new Nest shelter that mm-hmm. we have, and we appreciate that. So we want them to see and hear from our agencies that we're still doing things. But I think maybe what they don't understand is the different, I guess, the struggles people have, like, everyone thinks service providers can kind of should be able to, I think people think this anyways, maybe they don't, but should be able to fix and get people housed. But there's so many different things like landlords, not saying mm-hmm. they're, but the background checks, having to have a good credit score. And I mean, all the different things that affect it, it was stuff that we can't fix, you know? Mm-hmm. And so there are some legislation that could be, that can become helpful that we can't just do with a service, I guess.
Yeah, I would second that the complexities of the people that we work with will blow your mind sometimes on what is the one thing that is holding them back from a housing opportunity. Maybe it's multiple things, maybe it's one thing, maybe it's that debt, it could be that criminal history, maybe they're disabled but they haven't been able to get income for years because the disability process takes so long. So that's a really common thing we see in our seniors as well. And then accessibility to apartments, yes. if they're using wheelchairs or other equipment, like it's very limited which apartments have elevators.
Yeah, and I would add to the criminalization part is huge. I think they've been recently outlawed camping in places, and that's a huge fear because if we can't just get rid of, you know, the quote unquote problem of homelessness, you know, mm-hmm. it's just going to go somewhere else. Also the people sitting in jail that are losing housing opportunities mm-hmm. and getting, like I said, just trying to find somewhere to live and getting a trespassing charge, like that stuff there, it's a policy related crime, mm-hmm. you know? And
so both of you have seen strategies that have maybe worked better in other areas, in other parts of the country, maybe a strategy or two that you've thought about in your mind that you wish you could implement maybe right now here in North Dakota, here in Grand Forks. Anything come to your mind?
Yeah, I guess like I would just a giant permanent supportive housing unit and a mm-hmm. huge emergency shelter, like not mm-hmm. huge, but bigger than what we have now.
Let me ask you
low barrier.
Ask you this question, and I want to be very sensitive. There may be some listeners who are saying, well, I didn't get a free house. Mm-hmm. I didn't get a free place to live. What would you want to tell them?
Certainly can speak to that. I'll tell you, it's certainly not free if somebody is raking in income or if they have employment or they have disability income. Housing assistance is 30% of your income you're paying towards rent. You know, people who don't work in that don't know that. If they do have no income, maybe it is free for the rent, but the deposit is not. And then you're using community resources to try and get that deposit in. And then I would also argue that that might be where they start, but that's not usually where our clients end.
Yeah.
We're getting them income or we're getting them employment if they want it, but it's a small percentage of people that are just getting free housing, free healthcare. Like,
but I would say that if you didn't get a free house, because this isn't really, like she said, it's not a free house, but a large percentage of the people that we serve are minority populations, vulnerable mm-hmm. populations. Like, and I would say that they likely, people have received opportunities, you know, like I've struggled in my life, but I had a family that supported me when I got home from the things, you know, that I did and or had to go through. I think that the opportunity, there's not equitable opportunity for everybody, especially people who are of the minority.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would say, like, I do think that we struggle in the area of like emergency outreach street type of mental health. We have Northeast has a crisis team and it's basically two people mm-hmm. and it's not enough. They're completely always doing stuff. And I do outreach case management type of stuff where I go out, you know, and meet people where they're at. A lot of places cannot do that. They just simply mm-hmm. can't. They have appointments all the time. And I think the mental health people aren't necessarily going to, if this is severe, they're not coming in to get help. They need someone like to go to them and they're having, and we just don't have that ability to work after hours either. Everyone's mm-hmm. 8 to 5. So yeah, I think that we could do better in that way.
Absolutely, with the outreach and after hours.
As we wrap up our conversation, if there's one or two things that you hope folks who aren't in the shoes of a homeless family, a homeless child, or a homeless person, if they are not in their shoes, what should we think about? What should we do?
I'll say something. I guess what I would say is, I'm going to kind of relate to substance use. We know we have an opioid crisis and everything going on with the huge number, and basically everyone at this point can say they know someone who's been affected by, you know, mm-hmm. substance use, and unfortunately, like the rate of people that we're losing. So I think what I could say is the reason we want to get involved and do stuff is because I don't want to wait till you are someone that has someone affected by it, you know, because that's what's going to happen. It's increasing.
There may be some people listening who might be wanting to help, but mm-hmm. maybe afraid to help. Mm-hmm. What might you tell them?
Afraid as in afraid to work with the people that are experiencing mm-hmm. homelessness. I'll tell you, they're my favorite people in the entire world. So I don't know. They're people with stories and humor and sadness, and they want connection just as much as we do, even more. Because if you're in a homeless situation, you don't have support. You don't have your family or your friends that are supporting you, and they need that human connection in order to be okay mentally, physically, you know, community-wide. Like, there's some lovely supports in our community, like Love in Action and Mountain Brook, that really support that community support.
I do understand it, though. I do understand how people, mm-hmm. there's a lot of negative, mostly press is a lot of times something that's negative or something that happened or someone who was murdered or whatever going mm-hmm. on, right? So I think it's understandable. It's just educating and experience, but also you can always look at our web or on the Facebook page and use the QR code, and you can donate money if you're afraid.
Yes,
That's always an option. Not everyone has to get mm-hmm. involved personally, you know.
But money's needed for this issue.
Money is absolutely needed. As Robbie said, we have QR code and we have a whole donation campaign website called Better World. It's linked on our Facebook page, everything, where we kind of talk about what the goals are.
What's the name of your Facebook page?
It is just Greater Grand Forks Hunger and Homelessness Awareness, and we intend to use that for the years to come.
They can also vote in favor of things that aren't going to hurt homeless people.
Absolutely.
Things like that.
I need to drill down on that a little bit. What is something that might hurt homeless people?
Well,
I mean, the bulldozing of encampments, that's not helping anybody. Honestly, like Robbie said, it's just going to move the homelessness problem somewhere else.
What might you say to the person? Well, those encampments need to go elsewhere because then I will feel safer when I walk on the trail by mm-hmm. the river. That's an issue in Fargo.
Yeah, that is an mm-hmm. issue in Fargo. You are correct.
I do get the sentiment. I do. Like, obviously, we're in different positions because our fear is kind of non-existent with our positions. I understand where other people would have that, and I really do. I guess I would just try and encourage thinking bigger picture here on that you have a large group of people in Fargo specifically or other encampments that it's a communal mass, like, displacement. And if you think about the emotions and the safety and if you don't want them to be homeless anymore, you know, and you want them to get their resources, you're taking that away on a grand scheme versus just your one feeling of feeling uncomfortable or unsafe.
So also I would say that people in general should be safe, right? I mean, in general, you always want to be jogging at 5 a.m. with someone doing all that. But also that's the stereotype I'm talking about as well, is that when you're running down, the homeless person is just going to jump out and attack you. Uh-huh. And that's just not reality. You know, education for people. We need to get more education out there, get more people. Persons mm-hmm. we're talking about, though, are part of our community, and getting them involved in the community, mm-hmm. coming to our events with lived experience, speaking on it so that people can relate to them and know that they're just like you and me. We all have the mm-hmm. same stuff going on. They just don't have a home.
Kelly, there's an organization called the Blue Zone Organization. They've created a video to raise awareness. What's that all about?
Yeah, so the Blue Zone Project is a division of the Grand Forks Public Health, and they created and produced a video where they have some people of lived experience as well as service providers.
Lived experience of being homeless?
Being, for their specific video, people who have been hungry or gone without food. Maybe that intersects with homelessness, but not all of them did. And it's to draw awareness that we have hunger in our community and neighbors should not feel alone and that there's help. The video will drive people to the Live Well Grand Cities Food Access website, where people can fill out an online form at the bottom of the page to get involved. The video will be done next week, and it'll be shown at our Grand Forks City Council meeting on November 18th. It will also be shown at our luncheon on November 19th for Hunger and Homelessness Week, and will be online on Facebook.
Robbie Hassett, she's a permanent supportive housing case manager for the Grand Forks Housing Authority. Thank you for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you for having us.
And Kelly Smith is a caseworker for Spectra Health.
Thanks
for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you for listening to us today. We appreciate it.
More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
Support for Pray Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor with Better Homes and Gardens Real Estate Alliance Group of Bismarck, specializing in helping new and established investors hit their goals from single family to commercial investing. Information can be found at BillDeanHomes.com.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round, everybody.
There's the walkout music. We introduce Dave Thompson. Of course, Dave needs no introduction. He's Prairie Public's longtime news director. Dave, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you so much. Now that we have walkout music, can I channel my inner Freddie Freeman?
Do. We'll be hitting it out of the park about every time, every day here. That would be awesome. I'll be all in favor of that. Anything baseball related, Dave, you know that.
You got it.
Dave, lots going on in the news. Apparently, there was an election. What was that, a year ago, 2 years? Oh, just last week, but we're beyond that now. And a bill will be introduced where the legislature may decide it's time to focus on nuclear power.
That's correct. They're asking for a thorough study of nuclear energy. It came from the Interim Energy Development and Transmission Committee, and they're talking about several things that are driving this. Number one, nuclear power is no longer out of fashion, is what he said. And two, there's a growing demand for nuclear power or some kind of power, especially in Northeast North Dakota, where they're going to propose more of these data centers, and also in South Central North Dakota, where data centers are being proposed. So they think nuclear could be a solution to that.
Most people agree it's a relatively clean source of energy and help the nation's energy needs. Dave, Governor Burgum spoke at a news conference recently talking about the need for a task force's report to have $96 million invested in housing. What was that all about?
Well, it's about the lack of housing being a barrier to people coming to North Dakota to fill jobs. They can't find affordable housing, and in some areas just can't find housing at all. So there's going to be a real look forward probably in the next legislative session to put some money toward that, to put some money toward housing, incentives for housing, and also maybe some changes in codes and making, low interest loans available for housing. So watch that one very carefully.
Dave, it will be interesting to watch because oftentimes with efforts like this, it's everyone agrees it's a problem. Everyone also says, not in my backyard.
That's correct. So that's the issue.
We'll have to see how that one does continue to go forward. Dave, the Republicans in North Dakota's legislature have pick their leaders for the 2025 legislative session. No surprises there, I'll bet.
No, and, tongue firmly in cheek, channeling my inner who, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. Because they've reelected Mike LaFour in the House as the majority leader, David Hogue in the Senate. The assistant leader's all the same as well. And basically that they had a little challenge in the House. Ben Koppelman from West Fargo got 32 votes, I believe. So, he fell short. But, in the Senate, there were no challenges. There was no races. Everybody got reelected, and they're now getting ready to go to work.
It's that time of the season, that's for sure. Dave, your news team reported that gas flares now have been, identified as contributing to two Western North Dakota wildfires.
That's correct. Now, this is the original report that Todd had. He talked to the fire marshal, and he said preliminary, this is what the report is showing, that at least two fires may have been caused by gas flares. There's going to be a final report coming out very soon, and I think everybody's going to be watching that one very carefully. And I should say, Craig, just another thing that's pending now is going to FEMA, and they have already told the state, don't rush it. Take your time, get your figures in a row, and then submit it to us. So,
supported there originally by Governor Burgum.
Absolutely.
Dave, Summit Carbon Pipeline decision could be coming down Friday from the North Dakota PSC. What's more there?
Well, remember the original decision, they denied it on a 2-1 vote. But they allowed the company to correct some what they called errors in their application. They had another round of hearings from the Public Service Commission. Now the PSC is ready to have a final say on it, and that's coming tomorrow.
It's a big deal. This is a huge multi-billion-dollar pipeline network. Dave, if you'll refresh my memory, this will gather carbon emissions, won't it, from ethanol plants in five states, including one here in Castleton.
That is correct. That is correct. Five states. And that's a lot of carbon capture in this pipeline.
Dave, Veterans Day was celebrated this week and at the State Heritage Center in Bismarck.
That's a wonderful event because not only do you have the indoor event at the big auditorium in the Heritage Center, then they go out to the memorial that's on the Capitol grounds. And the memorial was designed that on the 11th day, the 11th hour, the sun, if the sun is shining, it will shine on North Dakota. And that does work. So it's very nice.
Very nice. Dave, what struck me about the story that you wrote is North Dakota's new National Guard Adjutant General Mitchell Johnson. He spoke at the ceremony with an emphasis on asking young people to step up and serve.
The National Guard has been on a recruiting, shall we say, mission for a little while. You know, the young people are not necessarily joining the National Guard the way they had been in the past. So they're trying to emphasize service to your country, also the benefits from joining the National Guard in terms of tuition assistance, that type of thing. So he's hoping that that message gets out, that people who have younger, you know, like nieces and nephews, maybe they want to encourage them to become a Guard member.
Dave, on the same topic here, what's the status now of the North Dakota's upcoming military museum? Are there any updates?
Well, we have updates. We have a basic drawing of what it's going to look like. It's going to be a nice addition to the actual Heritage Center campus. And the fundraising is underway, and I don't have any figures, but I have been told that fundraising is going very well. So we may know something in a few months.
Dave, there's a search organized here this weekend for missing and Indigenous people from Fort Totten. What do you know about that?
What I know about it, it's a two-day search, and they're looking for two Indigenous people who disappeared from Spirit Lake Reservation this year. And that has been an issue in among Native Americans and on reservations, that they want to put more emphasis on finding missing Indigenous people, because there are some cases that people have been missing for a while.
Dave, any more election fallout you want to make us aware of? I know that we've heard more from Governor-elect Armstrong.
Well, not too much at this point. I think everybody's going to wait and settle in. The big thing that's coming up, of course, will be Governor Burgum's last budget address to the legislature. That's apparently going to be scheduled on December 4th, and Prairie Public will provide live coverage of that. And that will be his last budget, and then they turn over the keys, basically, figuratively, to the new governor.
Dave, what are you and your team working on?
More follow-up on this nuclear thing we were talking about. I think there's more follow-up about the actual demand in northwestern North Dakota, which seems to be big. Basin Electric's got some projects to bring more power lines to the area, and there are some projects to do some natural gas peaker plants. And what is driving it? It's driving it because it's a good place for these data centers to locate because it's wide open spaces and they've got a lot of room.
Data, data, data.
Data, data.
We review the news each and every Thursday here on Main Street with our good friend, our longtime news director, Dave Thompson. Dave, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome, Craig.
Gather around, everybody. I'm gonna tell you a story about a little fella.
More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Dave Thompson. I've been a regional news reporter on Prairie Public for more than 40 years. I've lived only two places in my life, Grand Forks and Bismarck, but I'm very familiar with the state of North Dakota. I think that helps me because I have the innate understanding of what happens in North Dakota and how people here react to it. When I'm producing a news story, I'm looking for A, the importance of the story, but B, I'm looking for people who can tell the story. And it's more important that I'm just kind of the facilitator for it, and that I'm interviewing people who can actually tell you the story, talk about the issue, and tell you how important it is. I believe in public radio journalism, we try to get more to the heart of the matter, and we try to present as many sides as possible of what's going on. I think that's very valuable. So listen for regional news on Prairie Public, telling North Dakota's story.
With the fanfare, we now know that it's Thursday here on Main Street. We welcome in our in-house movie critic extraordinaire, Matt Olien. Matt, how are you?
I'm okay, Craig.
Matt, this movie is Anora, latest film by Sean Baker. Let's listen to the trailer, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about the movie.
You want someone who speaks Russian? Let's go.
No, no, I'm eating my food.
You're killing me.
He's a spender. Come on, let's go.
Hello, this is the beautiful Annie.
Hi, I'm Annie.
I'm Ivan.
It was really weird.
Like, I love him.
No way.
Yes way.
Bruh.
And I'm seeing him again tonight.
Will you marry me?
Seriously?
Seriously.
3 carrots.
What about 4?
You hit the lotto, bitch.
I know.
Bro, didn't I tell you?
All right, Matt, we've heard the trailer. When I first saw this trailer, I immediately thought about Pretty Woman, right? And I have a feeling this is a lot more complex than that.
I think people are going to this. What I think is going on, and I've heard a lot of negative reaction to this movie from, let's just say, mainstream filmgoers. I think they think they're going to a Pretty Woman situation, and they are not. That's not what they're doing. This is a Sean Baker film. It's not a pleasant 90s rom-com like Julia Roberts and Richard Gere did. So very different from that. Sean Baker, famous for The Florida Project, starring Willem Dafoe. That's probably his most famous movie. This is definitely one of the best films of the year. In my opinion, it's about 13 minutes too long, or it would have been a masterpiece, I think. They could have trimmed things, especially in the first half of the movie. So yes, this film centers around a exotic dancer and sometimes escort named Annie. Her given name is Anora. She's of Russian immigration, Russian descent. And she's played amazingly by Mikey Madison, who people probably don't know, but you better get to know her because she's probably going to be a Best Actress nominee this year for this movie. So she dances at a high-end club in New York City. She lives in the Brighton Beach area at night, which is populated by a lot of Russian and Lithuanian immigrants. And she eventually meets a rich son of a Russian oligarch, and his name is Ivan, played by Mark Edelstein. And he throws all kinds of money at her, and he's young and stupid and careless, and he just kind of lives like there's no tomorrow, there's no consequences. He's got money to throw around. And eventually they start seeing each other in kind of a transactional relationship. You know, he's got the money, she doesn't. They spend weeks together, and then kind of all heck breaks loose at some point. Can't get into too many plot details, Craig, because I want people to see this. But it's really an interesting portrait of, you know, sex workers and what they do and kind of the, you know, constraints they're under. And they will, you know, they need money. This guy's got money. That's what it's about. Now, about halfway through the movie becomes something different. It's really, you're really watching two different movies. The first half of the movie is Annie and Ivan, played by Mark Edelstein, kind of, you know, hanging out, going to parties, doing what they do, transactional. She's making money, to be his, you know, mistress or whatever. And then the second half of the film, all of a sudden, some Russians show up, and they are employed by Ivan's father, and they want to know what the heck is going on. And that's all I'll say, because the rest of the movie almost turns into a madcap comedy as they're chasing around New York City, and it almost feels like it could have been directed by Preston Sturges, Howard Hawks, Ernst Lubitsch, way back in the 30s and 40s. These are the kind of madcap movies they made, often surrounding a heroine, you know, kind of a rich heiress type person, although, you know, that's not what Annie is. Except much more explicit. So it feels like a Sturges Hawks movie in the second half, but much more explicit with, you know, swearing and guns and violence and sex and whatnot. So it becomes two different movies, and it outstays its welcome, I said, by about 10 to 15 minutes. But I want to say that I did like it. There's a couple really good supporting performances by the Russians who show up. Karan Karagulian plays Toros. He's kind of the leader of this group that shows up. And then Yuri Borisov plays kind of a thug, and he really has the more interesting performance. And you're going to have to go see it to really see what I'm talking about. He's kind of torn between what they're doing there. and kind of sees Annie's perspective on things as to what she's doing there with Yvonne. It's very complicated, but essentially it's about a sex worker trying to make it and kind of the things they go through to do that, to attach themselves to rich men. And let me just say the final scene of the movie, which I won't reveal, but I want to say is one of the most surprising and touching final scenes I've seen in a movie in quite a long time. You're going to have to go see it to see what I'm talking about. But it really kind of puts a bow on everything. A little ambiguous too, but I really liked it.
Matt, everything that I've read about this movie, at least the first half of the movie, says it's really a fairly realistic depiction of the life of sex workers in many ways. Did you agree with that?
Yes, and I think Sean Baker has kind of dedicated this movie to sex workers everywhere who, you know, get demeaned. And, you know, people fall into all kinds of professions, Craig, that they maybe didn't dream about going into, but people have to make a living, right? And I think that's you end up sympathizing with Annie, Honora. You sympathize with her character. She's the central character in this movie. You know, Yvonne, who she meets, the rich Russian, is really kind of a side character, especially in the second half of the movie when the Russians show up and they become the side characters to her and everything kind of turns into this crazy comedy. But it's not just a comedy. It's also touching and tragic as we see the perspective of Annie trying to make a living. You know, what is this Yvonne about? Is he really on the up and up that he likes her, or is this transactional? What is this? And she keeps her guard. You know, people, workers like her, have to keep their affections to a certain level, a lower level. I suspect that's what they do to not get involved with people. But you get the feeling watching it that you end up sympathizing with Annie, and I certainly did.
Matt, it seems
it's an amazing performance. Let me say too, sorry to interrupt you. Mikey Madison it's an incredible performance. It's kind of this combination of streetwise, you know, with a Fran Drescher type voice to her, streetwise, you know, sex worker, and she's funny in parts, and she's loud, and she's sexy. So she's got kind of all of it going on. It's an amazing performance.
Matt, it's interesting that this is really a blend, as you describe it, of a drama and then a comedy. How's that tonal shift handled, Matt? And it must work because you really like the film.
It does work. So, you know, not that there aren't funny parts in the first half of the movie, but things really get going when the Russians show up at the house of Ivan, this amazing house that he lives in New York City. And so it's a quick tonal shift. You know, all of a sudden they're there. And the film changes and people are chasing about and screaming and yelling and guns are pulled and blah, blah, blah. And it does change on a dime, but you're okay with it. I was okay with the change. I really was.
So, Matt, is this a film that will really be off-putting to people who don't like a lot of sex in their movies that they watch? Or is it handled also in a way that makes that less of the theme?
There's a lot of sex in this movie. There's a lot of transactional sex going on. So I do think it could be off-putting to some people. I've read some audience reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, which are not the same as the critics are saying. Some people walked out of the movie. I think the screening I went to Saturday night, I felt like there were some people there that were expecting Julia Roberts and Richard Gere. And they got more than they bargained for. Let me just say that.
All right, Matt, before we get to our Oscar trivia, we like to get to that towards the end of our time together. What else do you have coming up for us here on Main Street?
Next week, we'll review A Real Pain with Kieran Culkin and Jesse Eisenberg. And then, of course, November 22nd, the big 2024 version of Barbenheimer that weekend will be Gladiator 2 and Wicked the same weekend.
Matt, do you think that's going to work out like the Barbenheimer event worked out last year?
That's a really good question. Oppenheimer is a film that should not have made as much money as it did. You know, it's a biopic about a nuclear scientist. But a lot of people that went to Barbie went to Oppenheimer. So they're trying to push people to see a double feature on that weekend. We'll see. I don't know. I can't quite get a feel for this. The film I really can't get a feel for is Wicked. I'm a little suspicious of the casting of Ariana Grande and Cynthia Erivo. Gladiator 2, the early buzz is good on that. So we'll see.
We've established that this movie is not Pretty Woman, but I have a Pretty Woman-related Oscar question. That movie was nominated in two different Academy Award categories. Which categories were they, and which were the winners then in that category?
So Julia Roberts, yes, was nominated for Best Actress in Pretty Woman, loses to Kathy Bates in Misery. Best Song.
Madonna.
Madonna wins. Is that from the Dick Tracy movie?
We've been to the movies with Matt Olien. Matt, it's always great to visit with you. More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Daybook for November 14th. On this date, in 1936, state and federal officials had evidence against some criminals. After a year-long investigation, the story broke. Newspapers across the country reported on a celebrity extortion plot hatched in a North Dakota penitentiary. Two convicts were put in solitary confinement. A former prison guard was arrested, and an outside accomplice was identified. The targets of the conspirators were four opera stars: Lily Pons, Carmela Pacella, Rosa Poncela, and Lucretia Borre. Theodore Larson, a life-term prisoner, created fake photos of the singers. He superimposed their images onto those of nude women in indecent poses. The original images had been smuggled into the prison by George Schultz, the former guard. Larson then took photos of the altered images. Authorities described Larson as a model prisoner and a mass killer. He had shot his wife and three in-laws, doused them with kerosene, and set them on fire. Larson pleaded insanity due to distress over child custody. The would-be extortionist became interested in opera after another inmate bragged about having a luxurious affair with one of the singers and showed off racy photos. They likely weren't fooled, but may have been inspired. Frank Fowler, imprisoned for fraud, was tasked with selling the fake pictures to the opera stars after his imminent release. Upon release, he was promptly arrested again. Prison officials labeled him one of the worst liars they had encountered. While in prison, Fowler claimed military benefits from both Canada and the U.S., stating he was a mechanical engineer and physician. He had a history of mail fraud, forgery, bad checks, and false pretenses. He served time in federal and state prisons, as well as military detention. He had various aliases, dates of birth, and birthplaces, but was originally from North Dakota. Peter Kateros from Buffalo, New York, was an outside accomplice. He faced charges conspiring to use the U.S. mail for extortion. He sent the obscene pictures used by Larson and Fowler for their photographic creations. It was unclear whether he also intended to participate in the extortion at the time of the report. The investigation also thwarted a planned prison break and the murder of another guard. While Schultz was not charged in the escape plot, he had facilitated uncensored mail for the convicts. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Lise Erdrich. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
A new science fiction show tells the story of women who were powers behind the throne.
As we know from our politics in the UK, and maybe you might feel in your politics, sometimes it's not the person at the podium, but the shady characters to one side that you need to keep an eye on.
Olivia Williams and Emily Watson talk about Dune, Prophecy, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are grateful that you have spent time with us. Tomorrow at 3 o'clock Central, we'll air The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. Jeremy will ask the question, what did the election teach you about America?
And at 7 p.m. Central, we'll have Science Friday with Ira Flatow. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend. We'll see you again Monday, right here on Main Street.